The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're taking a look at culture and news. Oprah Winfrey and Dwayne Johnson are teaming up to help those devastated by the Maui wildfires. The People's Fund of Maui will distribute money directly to locals. 3 weeks ago, wildfires blazed through Maui, leaving thousands of people without homes. Since then, Oprah, who lives part-time on the island, has been visiting resilience hubs, talking to residents about their experiences, and securing much-needed necessities for those who lost everything. Over the past several weeks, she has also been hard at work developing a long-term relief plan. Today, Oprah and Dwayne Johnson announced the launch of the People's Fund of Maui, a 501c3 charitable service fund to distribute cash directly to those who were displaced by the fire. To get it started, Oprah and Johnson have donated $10 million and are inviting others to contribute to what will be an ongoing effort. Oprah and Johnson collaborated closely with an advisory board made up of local community members and respected elders to ascertain what would be the most helpful. Together, they determined that every single adult who lives in the affected area and was displaced by the wildfires in Lahaina and Kula is eligible to receive $1,200 per month to help them through this period of recovery. I have been meeting with people throughout the community who were impacted by the fires over the last few weeks, asking what they most needed and how I would be of service, Oprah shared. The main thing I kept hearing was their concern over how to move forward under the immense financial burden of rebuilding their life. The community has come together in so many wonderful ways, and my intention is to support those impacted as they determine what rebuilding looks like for them. If you'd like to help contribute to those impacted by the fires in Maui, you can visit peoplesfundofmaui.org. Over in style, we have 8 expert tips to help your clothes last longer. Oprah Daily creative director Adam Glassman spills the secrets. As far as shopping goes, there's nothing like that high when you score things you truly love. Flattering color? Check. Perfect fit? Yup. Doable price point? Done. And when you take home those prized pieces and start wearing them, and the love for them becomes real, you'll want to ensure they stay in rotation. Not only do we want to look great in what we put on, but we also want what we put on to stay great looking. The good news is that keeping your wardrobe in tip-top shape is relatively easy. It just requires a dash of proactiveness and some mindful maintenance. Washing, drying, storing, hanging, and repairing things the right way is the ticket for optimizing how long they're going to last. To help you care for the coveted clothing that's already in your closet and any newness you usher in, we went straight to our resident style guru, Oprah Daily Creative Director Adam Glassman. As we close out the carefree days of summer and prepare to bring all those fall faves forward, he shares his tried and tested tips and tricks to ensure your pieces stay as pristine as possible. Buy quality clothes. When it comes to clothing, having less can be more. If you invest in quality fabrics and construction, pieces will last longer. You'll also be more sustainable since you'll be buying fast fashion less often, says Glassman. Machine wash the right way. First and foremost, read the instructions on the garment to know how best to care for it. If you have a stain on your clothing, treat it immediately, even if you're going to wash it later on. Zip and hook everything to avoid snags. Then turn things inside out. You'll prevent fading. And keep prints and any designs from cracking, explains Glassman. Also, consider going with an environmentally friendly detergent. It will be gentler, not just on fabrics, but also on your skin. launder less. Try to wear pieces like jeans, blouses, and wool or jersey dresses a few times before you wash them, suggests Glassman. You'll use less water, which is better for the environment, spend less of your precious time, and lessen wear and tear. Consider hand washing. And make sure you use cold water. Not only is the old-fashioned way an inexpensive green alternative to a washing machine, but it's also the way to save delicate fabrics sans dry cleaner. When you clean things by hand, you prevent the rubbing of all the different materials that have been thrown in the washing machine together, which breaks down fabric, Glassman says. Air dry whenever possible. The lint you see in your dryer comes from, you guessed it, your clothes. So when you air dry, you're minimizing that wearing down, preventing items from shrinking over time, and conserving energy. Of course, this depends on the climate where you live, but the sun is great for drying rather than using energy-guzzling dryers, says Glassman. Nothing beats that fresh air scent, but drying indoors is an option too. A big bonus? Air drying regularly can reduce the carbon footprint of your household by over 2,000 pounds a year. When you do need a dryer, use special fabric softening reusable dryer balls to help reduce drying time by 25%. Fold your knits. You might be inclined to throw sweaters on the nearest handy hanger, but fight that urge. They'll stretch out, and heavier ones will break your hangers, warns Glassman. Instead, fold and store them on shelves to keep them from getting misshapen. Take organization up a notch by arranging sweaters by color, weight, and fabric. You'll streamline the what-to-wear portion of your day, since things will be easier to find. Use storage containers. Clothing needs breathing room, says Glassman, so you don't want to confine it in plastic bags that are completely sealed. Instead, quality storage boxes will help keep pests out and protect clothes from the elements, especially mildew-causing moisture. Opt for natural mothball repellent, not chemical-laden balls, and avoid storing stuff in attics, basements, or garages, as those spots are more prone to temperature changes. A word of warning, don't spray fragrance or freshener on your stored clothing. It will accelerate yellowing, says Glassman. Instead, he suggests putting a small amount of baking soda in a breathable pouch and adding that to the container. Be on the mend. We're not suggesting you develop project runway-level sewing skills, but a little needle and thread work can go a long way, says Glassman. It's easy to fix a small hole or sew on a new button instead of throwing out the garment. It's also better for the environment to keep clothing out of landfills. If you prefer to leave things to the pros, a good local tailor is always a useful contact to have. Either way, it's a good idea to keep those little packets of extra thread, beads, or buttons that come with some clothing and have a sewing kit handy. Along with this article, there are some suggestions of things you might be interested in buying to help with your clothes. We have Blue Land Laundry Detergent Tablets. They start a starter set. It's $30 at Amazon. And they recommend Brook Linen Essential Detergent. It's $22 at Brook Linen. And then Brook Linen Fabric Refresher. It's $19 at Brook Linen. And Delicate Wash, $30 at the Laundress. Luhu Wool Dryer Balls, 3-pack. They're $33 at luhu.com. And Luhu is spelled L-O-O-H-O-O. The Pottery Barn Teen Oversized Folding Laundry Drying Rack. It's $59 at Pottery Barn Teen. And the Container Store, OXO Good Grips Folding Sweater Drying Rack. It's $19 at the Container Store. Box Legend Shirt Folding Board. It's $20 at Amazon. A Clothes Doctor Rescue Me Nature Moth Repellent Scent Bag. It's $8 at ClothesDoctor.com. The Container Store Natural Cotton PEVA, that's P-E-V-A, storage bags. They're $16 at Container Store. An underbed fabric bin with lid light gray bright room, $14 at Target. And the Coquimbo Sewing Kit, that's C-O-Q-U-I-M-B-O, $6 at Amazon. In beauty, I tried new hidden braces and my teeth have never looked better. The pro, straight teeth in record time. Con, they're still braces. Read on for my in-depth review. I kept a secret for 8 months. Hidden behind my bottom teeth were the stealthiest braces the world has ever not seen. Unless I spilled the beans to someone, half the time to marvel, half the time to complain, nobody was the wiser. The teeth straightening technology is called InBrace, and as a beauty editor and a mom whose teeth rotated and gapped during pregnancy, thanks hormones, I was eager to test their power. I was also in the best of hands thanks to New York-based orthodontist Scott C. Schwartz, DDS, who is an InBrace master. Even though I was far from the most compliant patient, turns out it's key to stick to the appointment schedule, after 8 months I had perfectly straight teeth. And now, like a mom who tries to prepare her newly pregnant friend for life with a newborn, I'm compelled to impart the highs, the lows, and the why did nobody tell me that's. First, here's the difference between traditional braces, aligners, and lingual braces like InBrace. Compared to the hefty, rigid piece of metal that stripped my teeth in high school, InBrace, made of shape memory alloy, is high-tech and downright dainty. The thin, featherweight, flexible wire undulates in a pattern of narrow and wide zigzaggy curves that may seem haphazard, but as customized and purposeful. A computer program analyzes a 3D scan of your teeth to create the unique-to-you wire that snaps into brackets glued to the back of your teeth and pushes each tooth in exactly the right way. The wire has memory and wants to return to its straight nature, taking your teeth with it. This translates to teeth that should move more efficiently than they do with other alignment options. I offer all of them, and in my experience, InBrace is the least painful and quickest, Schwartz says. He goes on to explain that a traditional metal wire is rigid. Attach it to brackets, and it uses brute force to push the teeth. Like a punch, it hurts a lot at first and then dissipates. Aligners take a similar path. They start tight, applying a heavy force at first, and then loosen up. You see some movement quickly, but then nothing happens until it's time to graduate to the next wire, band, or tray. Overall, the force of the InBrace wire is more likely the steady weight of a hand. It's there, but mostly you notice it only if you think about it, except during the first 2 weeks, and read on for more about that. This is also why traditional braces call for monthly tightenings at the orthodontist's office and aligners are swapped every 2 weeks at home. InBrace requires a new wire, fitted at the orthodontist every 2 to 3 months. In my case, I had 6 visits, a consultation, the fitting, 3 wire changes, and then removal. Prices range from $3,000 to $10,000, depending on the type you choose and where you live. Note that not everyone is the right candidate for these options. Things like the size of your teeth and the space between them can affect which is right for you, and not everyone responds to InBrace the same way, which leads me to the highs and lows. After InBrace goes on, everyone has a 2-week adjustment period, Schwartz says. Then most people love their experience. Whether you're part of the majority or would describe your feelings as far less than amorous, the first few weeks are tough. For starters, you'll have a lisp. The more you practice speaking, the faster it'll go away. Schwartz handed me a printout of the Rainbow Passage and suggested I read it aloud often. Most of the time my speech was fine, but I still lisped occasionally for about a month. You'll also find that your mouth is very sore, especially for the first couple of days. Drinking something warm relaxes the wire a bit, giving you a brief reprieve. Advil helps. You can eat anything, but obviously something like a soup or a smoothie goes down a lot easier than biting into, say, crusty bread. Speaking of bread, it, and pretty much all other food, ends up lodged in your braces. And Edward Scissorhands has nothing on how well your braces can shred a salad. The huge positive? No one can see any of it. Over time, you'll get used to a few remnants of food sticking around after you eat. Then you'll beeline to a bathroom to brush and floss. The last pain point? Your tongue, which is in prime position to poke and press into the braces, can get cut up and develop a sore. The initial injury hurts, sure, but it's the re-injury, the accidental rub, the salt in the wound, so to speak, that happens whenever you eat or talk or move your tongue. it makes calm, easygoing people want to stomp and curse and pout. It's me. As with everyone else, this happens less and less often with time. And I'll note that I am but one reviewer. According to Schwartz, there are people out there who experience a little pain the first few weeks and then spend the rest of their journey ecstatic. In the words of Gwyneth Paltrow, I wish them well. Products that really help. Once you have a sore, you can try warm salt water rinses to ease the healing process, which runs its courses in a few days. Ideally, you'll learn to prevent them in the first place. For recurring pain, proceed right back to the orthodontist's office and ask for Soft Flow, a silicon covering that smooths out sharp areas on the brackets. At home, press bits of wax onto the spots that poke, or better yet, try Orthodots, which seem to stay on better than wax. The best way to get food out of your braces is to floss. Because of InBrace's unique curvy wire, you can still slide floss between your teeth. I also became a huge water flosser fan. I'd fill the reservoir with lukewarm water, aim the high-pressure steam at my brackets, then be amazed/horrified at the food bits that emerged. Afterward, my teeth felt next level clean. I had a water pick on my bathroom counter at home and a mini travel size by Moon in my handbag. I also loved how well the Philips Diamond Clean electric toothbrush reached into and around each bracket. After 8 months, Schwartz unclipped the InBrace wire and removed each bracket. His parting gift, besides the perfectly lined up teeth and extra wide smile, was a retainer and a reminder to wear it. Our teeth have memory, and while they won't necessarily go back to their original spots, they'll begin to rotate or gap again, especially as our bodies change throughout our lives, he explains. This is why I tell patients to wear their retainer at night for a lifetime. I'm on it. And this article also has a couple of recommendations to upkeep with something like this. The Waterpik Ultra Countertop Water Flosser. It's $60 at Walmart, $90 at JCPenney, and $70 at farmandfleet.com. Moon, the water flosser, $70 at Amazon. Philips Sanicare Diamond Clean Electric Toothbrush is $280 at Amazon, and Orvance Orthodots Clear are $14 at Amazon and $14 at Walmart. Okay, over in relationships. Struggling in a friendship? Maybe it's your attachment style. And that's not a bad thing. Here's how examining your earliest bonds can improve any relationship. Friendship might be the most complex relationship two human beings share. While there are reams of research about the benefits of long-term bonds, we don't talk enough about the difficult parts. The frustration of feeling like you're putting in more energy than the other person is giving back. The angst of needing extra support or affirmation but not knowing how to ask for it without sounding clingy. The guilt of feeling envious of your friend's accomplishments. The way we approach conflicts and fluctuations in friendships is influenced in part by our attachment styles and behaviors. Attachment theory, which focuses on the early relationship between a child and their primary caregivers, delineates three main attachment styles: anxious, preoccupied, avoidant, dismissive, and secure. The fourth style, disorganized attachment, or fearful avoidant, is under-researched in adults. During the formative years, children develop mental representations of themselves and others, says Brooke Feeney, Ph.D., and that's spelled F-E-E-N-E-Y, psychology professor at Carnegie Mellon University. They develop beliefs about whether they're worthy of love, attention, support, and protection. And they develop beliefs about whether other people can be depended and relied upon. Basically, during the first months and years of life, children learn what to expect from others, and they reach important conclusions about themselves. Given stable circumstances, these beliefs become central components of personality and guide their interactions with others. Though we originally form attachment bonds with our parents or primary caregivers, we eventually form them with romantic partners, mentors, and friends, too. According to Feeney, there are four criteria that qualify a relationship as a securely attached one. The other person is someone you resist separating from, whom you seek out in times of stress or crisis, whom you feel comfort and safety around, and whose connection feels essential. And when you feel confident in their availability and responsiveness to you, these people are your secure base, Feeney says, the foundation you need to step out into the world and explore, embrace challenges, and pursue goals. A secure attachment bond implies a certain level of expectation, trust, and intimacy. The safer and more emotionally intimate a relationship is, the more opportunities you have for self-disclosure and vulnerability, says Miriam Kiermaier, that's K-I-R-M-A-Y-E-R, Ph.D., a Montreal-based clinical psychologist and keynote speaker on social connection and friendship. But you also have more opportunities for conflict to arise. It's unsettling when the safety in a friendship feels threatened, but how we understand and communicate with each other during those times is crucial. If you're struggling to navigate a friendship right now, here's what these experts have to say about the role your attachment style might be playing and how to find resolution. Anxious attachment, preoccupied. What it means. An anxious attachment style is often the result of an inconsistent or chaotic relationship with one's primary caregivers. Those with this style worry about their loved ones distancing themselves or abandoning them and may resort to reassurance-seeking behavior as a result, Kiermaier says. We do a lot of bids for connection and attention when we're trying to hold on really tight, and sometimes we do that in ways that push people away because it's not the way they want to be connected, or it feels like too much. How it plays out. Feeney adds that people with an anxious attachment style doubt their own self-efficacy and yet struggle to fully receive the care and support they crave from others. Because of this, they can be hypervigilant and hypersensitive to signs of rejection and may misinterpret a friend's behavior as such. For example, when a friend sets boundaries, someone with an anxious attachment style may internalize this as a rejection or see it as a reflection of their worth or of the friendship rather than something the other person needs to do for themselves, Kiermaier adds. A healthier approach. When a friend turns down plans or sets a boundary, pay attention to how you interpret it, Kiermaier says. Once you get a clearer picture of the story you're telling yourself, then you can start to question the accuracy of it. Sometimes your internal narrative is a result of other experiences you've had or patterns you've observed, whether from parents, friends, or other close loved ones. Ask yourself, do I have any evidence to suggest that this is the beginning of the end of our friendship? Do I have any evidence to suggest that the boundary is even about me? Is there another way of looking at this situation? That's another really powerful question, Kiermaier says. Is this about them or about our friendship? Some research proposes that to form healthier friendships, an anxious type has to increase their confidence and self-reliance. But Feeney has found that another source for healthy confidence is for them to have at least one secure relationship with someone who responds sensitively to their attachment needs. I call this the dependency paradox, that true independence and self-sufficiency emerge because of one's ability to depend on others in times of need. Avoidant attachment, dismissive. What it means. Per attachment theory, avoidant attachments stem from a childhood where caretakers were unresponsive, unaffectionate, or straight-up neglectful. For these people, intimacy and closeness with others can bring great discomfort, and they find it difficult to rely or depend on others or to allow others to rely on them, Feeney says. They value self-reliance and try hard to keep their attachment system deactivated, so they defensively inhibit expressions of emotion and vulnerability. Seeking support in times of needs is risky and uncomfortable for them, and their friends often want them to be more open and intimate than they feel comfortable being. How it plays out. While anxiously attached people crave more closeness when threatened, the avoidantly attached seek the opposite. If the people in your life aren't going to be there for you, you don't need and don't want to need anyone. Instead of reaching out and making bids for connection, you withdraw, Kiermaier says. When you feel hurt, abandoned, unsafe, or uncertain, you're more likely to start declining plans and putting up physical and emotional distance. A healthier approach. In emotionally intimate relationships, getting hurt is inevitable. But it's important for you to challenge the belief that this means you won't be okay, or that you'll be unsafe, or that you'll always be alone and never find your people, Kiermaier says. The key here is tending to those fears with compassion and kindness, and trying to motivate yourself to be a little more open and vulnerable and present. It's not about telling yourself, I am doing such a terrible job of being a friend, or I'll never have friends unless I do this right. It's leaning into gentleness and saying, I am deserving of close friendship, and my friendships can benefit from my showing up in a slightly more vulnerable way. Rewriting your internal narrative to one where your friends like you, want to hear from you, and want to hear about the ups and downs in your life is an important healing step. Secure attachment. What it means. In childhood, you were able to consistently trust and rely on your caregivers, or you watched your caregivers exhibit trust toward each other. And because of this foundational base, you typically feel comfortable forming close bonds with others. But this doesn't mean you always feel secure and confident in friendship, both experts agree. How it plays out. Conflict and insecurity arise in all intimate relationships. And for a securely attached person, understanding a friend's different attachment behaviors can be challenging, Kiermaier says. You may more easily overlook things your friendship might benefit from. For example, you may not realize the power of your validity of your validating your friendship with, say, an anxiously attached friend who's engaging in a lot of reassurance-seeking behavior, and in turn that friend can feel dejected. A healthier approach. You may already handle relational conflict in a healthy way. Just remember that approaching the turbulent moments in your friendship with gentleness and curiosity, whether they stem from your own misgivings, your friend's attachment behaviors, or a mixture of several things, can make for a more trusting friendship. Whatever your attachment style, remember that it's just one piece of the puzzle impacting the dynamics in your friendship. Sustaining an intimate, long-term friendship requires self-awareness and self-compassion, says Kiermaier, and understanding all the factors influencing the ebbs and flows. We can ask ourselves, what is it about this friendship, the challenge at this moment, that feels scary? Kiermaier says, what am I worried about? Is this a fear of being rejected? Is this a fear of being unwanted? What am I really feeling at this moment? And the big question, how am I reacting to that threat? The point isn't to never fight, but rather to build a trusting friendship that withstands honest and difficult conversations. The closest, healthiest relationships and friendships are ones where people are able to voice that, Kiermaier says. The responsiveness and willingness to sift through conflict means your relationship can survive. Here's another article in Relationships, The Beauty in Realizing You Don't Just Love Your Mom, You Like Her. For the writer and her mother, it took a road trip through the vast desert to get close again. We're not 10 minutes away from the Albuquerque airport when my mom makes the first of many uncharacteristic remarks. I love the way the light looks on the mountains out here. I see that it is indeed slightly dusty, filtered, and warm, and against the cloudless blue sky, the Rocky Mountains glow a bright pink. But who knew Mom noticed light? I mull this newfound insight as my 83-year-old mom and I settle in for the first vacation with just the two of us in, well, ever. I grew up in a family of talkers. I don't mean we were chatterboxes or that the four of us, mom, dad, younger sister, and me, were exceptionally good conversationalists. I mean that the thing we did most often and, well, together was talk. When people ask about my childhood, my mind turns to the most ordinary of scenes. The absence of agenda or interruption, the sharing of stuff that happened and things that might. But between my adult move to the East Coast, the lure of my kids whenever we got together, and my lifelong dislike of phone calls, Mom and I hadn't done much talking in a long, long while. If we didn't have time for one of our easy, circuitous chats, there was always next visit, right? As years ticked by, I'd taken my favorite conversationalist for granted. A springtime road trip in New Mexico, a state I'd never visited and she and my dad had loved, with some long, low-stress stretches in the car, would test our compatibility as travel buddies. It would also let us chat. I craved this connection, and I was about to learn what it meant to my mom. Our six-day itinerary was carefully crafted to offer a little bit of everything. We would rendezvous in Albuquerque, me flying in from New Jersey and her from Ohio, for 2 days at one of the area's buzzy boutique inns. We'd drive 2 hours south to the small town of Truth, or Consequences, to soak in its mineral hot springs, then backtrack 3 hours north to the arty delight that is Santa Fe. Keeping one eye on those glowy mountains, Mom and I quickly come upon the verdant Rio Grande Valley. In 10 miles, we turn into the cottonwood tree-lined colonnade that welcomes you to Los Poblenos, a historic 1930s property on 25 acres of lavender fields, with buildings designed by seminal Santa Fe-style architect John Gall Meem, and gardens designed by one of the first female landscape architects of her time, Rose Greeley. The whole place is a model of regenerative organic farming with top-tier dining and incredible culture. We're here to learn about all of it, but in this moment we laugh over the memory of my sister's allergic sneezing fits every spring when the single cottonwood on her property would shed extravagantly. After checking in, we drop off our bags and explore the property, snapping pictures of peacocks and hens preening near the silos, then, feeling vacation adventurous, order lavender lattes at Campo, the inn's farm-to-fork restaurant. Mom plays food critic and describes it as decidedly pleasant. At dinner, she tastes my asparagus soup and identifies the unique flavor. It must be borage, an herb I think I saw growing on the property. They probably used the seeds in the soup. I tell her that not only is she the most well-read person in my life, but she knows a little about a lot of things I want to. Gardens, U.S. history, cooking. The next day, we do yoga in a yurt. Mom's new knee holds its own, and she makes cute jokes at her own expense about needing a chair, and further explore the property. I'm gaping at the original punched tin light fixtures in the main hacienda when I hear Mom across the ballroom. She's noticing the pueblo rain clouds carved into the ceiling, a detail I had completely overlooked in my fascination with the shiny chandeliers. I'd forgotten how much she knew about this stuff, and she and my father having been antique dealers specializing in American decorative arts. We retire to our luxurious yet simply appointed room and watch recaps of King Charles's coronation, gossiping about the royals and recalling many decades ago when I woke up in our childhood home to watch his wedding to Lady Diana. I think we're good this way, me and Mom. Quiet, unhurried, just spending time. I vow silently to make space for it in the years to come. Next stop is the small town of Truth or Consequences, known as America's most affordable spa town. Arriving, we learn it's siesta day, so most of the restaurants are closed. After a dust-whipped walk down Main Street, we find shade and green chili cheeseburgers at the town's drive-in. I'm hot and annoyed, futilely wiping the table every 5 minutes to keep it dust-free. Mom complains not once. She regales me with stories about my parents' trip to Canyon de Chelly, Arizona's dramatic sandstone-walled canyon that preserves centuries-old ancestral Puebloan dwellings and rock art. "I think I like New Mexico better than Arizona in terms of what we're seeing," she says. "It feels less built up, more authentic somehow." We have massages, mineral soaks, and a bison dinner at Sierra Grande that night, and then awake refreshed early the next morning for our guided drive through Ladder, one of Ted Turner's large landscape conservation properties in nearby Caballo. Our guide for the day, Heidi, isn't much of a talker at first, but I have Mom sit in front, and she warms Heidi up with questions about water levels in New Mexico and what might be blooming seasonally. We stop to admire an ancient hummingbird pictograph. "The hummingbirds are already out in Ohio," Mom says, climbing out of the Land Rover. "It's about 2 weeks earlier than usual." On they go, the two of them talking birds and climate change. The next day's drive up to Santa Fe flies. We discuss my kid's impending departure for college, and I ask about her own experience at Mount Holyoke. A music major, Mom took one class in geology and managed to retain most of it. That night, we have dinner at Skyfire, Auberge Resorts Collection, The restaurant at the centuries-old Bishop's Lodge reopened in 2021 as an unpretentious luxury lodge offering five-star dining, outdoor adventure, and spiritual healing. Mom chats up the waiter, and they share observations about the New Mexican topography. I alternate between bemused observer and active participant. For our final day, I'd booked us a symphony of sound wellness experience, followed by intuitive healing sessions. It's meant to be a quiet, restful afternoon, because later we're having a dinner billed as an adventure of flavors at Saison, a restaurant in downtown Santa Fe. Mom has lifelong friends who live in town, so she begs off the scheduled treatments for lunch with the couple. We can meet up later that night for dinner. When we return to our respective homes, I ask Mom what she enjoyed the most. "I guess I just enjoy talking to someone," she says. "When you live alone, you don't realize how little you talk. So I enjoyed catching up on you and the kids. I also liked talking about nothing." My mind goes to that last meal together at Cezanne, with its vivid gallery walls, bold Mexican cuisine, and impeccable service. I see her laughing with a charismatic chef, the James Beard Award-winning Fernando Olea, who spent more time chatting up guests than managing the food in his well-run kitchen. And I think simply, how nice. The dinner, the time together, the talking, and ultimately, how nice it is to realize how much you like someone you love. We're staying in relationships, but this next article is kind of a flip side to the one we just read. This one's called "You're Allowed to Cut Ties with a Toxic Parent." Here's how to handle this act of self-preservation and the fallout. No matter how far you are into adulthood, the idea of ending a relationship with an emotionally abusive parent can make you feel backed into a corner like a little kid. When raging toxicity pummels you from one side and waves of guilt hit you from the other, cutting ties can feel unimaginable. People are wired to seek affection and nurturing from their parents. And that's why, despite knowing that our parents might be toxic or unhealthy, we're always searching for that love, explains New York City-based licensed social worker Mina B. There's a biological pull. In her just-released book, Owning Our Struggles, the social worker, author, and writer, who goes by the pseudonym Mina B, that's M-I-N-A-A and then the letter B, describes herself as Black Hispanic, a woman and the child of immigrants. The last of 13 children in a blended family, she was the first person in her family to get a college degree and the first to continue on to graduate school and earn a master's degree. When she isn't sharing life-affirming guidance with hundreds of thousands of followers via her social media platforms, she's working with companies through her consulting business. She's also on the advisory committee for the mental fitness company WonderMind, co-founded by Selena Gomez, and this September she'll host the latest season of the Very Well Mind podcast for the mental health platform Very Well Mind. Here she walks us through one of the hardest decisions a human can make. What are some clear signs that you have a toxic or emotionally abusive parent? If you're a child, it's having a parent who physically assaults you. This shows that a parent lacks emotional maturity. Instead of using language to express their frustration, they resort to physical violence. A lot of adult children are still healing from the trauma of being physically abused as kids. As an adult, a sign is that when you try to have a conversation with a parent about harm they may have caused, they deflect and defend themselves. They lack accountability. They have a very difficult time owning their actions and tend to blame. So they'll say, "Well, you were a problematic child, so I had to treat you this way." They might say, "Even now, as an adult, you're irresponsible, so I have to scream at you. I have to talk down to you." Another sign is disguised hostility. A parent will say cruel things under the guise of friendliness, like, "Well, I'm really surprised that you have a date tonight because, you know, you're so big. You've gained so much weight, but I'm so happy someone wants to date you." But I think the number one thing is pathological lying. They gaslight you because they have a different version of the story. They have this inability to see beyond themselves. Everything is about them and how they feel, not how their child feels. How do you know if you should work on a relationship like this or just end it? Attempts at repairing ruptures are important, and that is often the first step I encourage people to take. There are parents who are not aware that their behaviors can be abusive because parenting is often intergenerational, and intergenerational trauma gets passed down through the family system. So parents engage in toxic behaviors because that's how they were raised. You could say, "Your actions hurt me. You say you love me as a parent, and I want you to understand that I don't feel loved when you speak to me this way. I don't feel loved when you talk down to me." The first step is being vulnerable enough to say, "You've hurt me, and I need you to understand how you continue to hurt me." Based on how they react, you'll know whether or not it's possible to repair the relationship. How can you prepare for this painful conversation? The first step is seeking support, which can look like going to a therapist, group therapy, or joining a support group. Make sure you're surrounded by people who can validate your experience, people who are not going to judge you, people who can listen and hold space for all the things that have happened. Next, you need a clear plan for what you're going to say to your parent or parents. You could use the same language as I had suggested above, but add sentences like, "I don't feel safe continuing in this relationship, and I've decided I would like some distance. I've tried repairing our issues, but it feels like the best way for me to heal is to cut ties and no longer stay in touch. I feel uncomfortable with our current dynamic and would like to take a break. During this time, I won't be conversing with you and the family or attending gatherings until I feel ready to reconnect. I would like us to have some space and would appreciate it if you respect me in this decision to have some distance." Does it have to be all or nothing? When you're in that contemplation stage, you might dip your toe in the water and then step back. Like, "I thought I was ready. I'm actually not ready." That is okay. For some, cutting ties can look like I blocked them, I went cold turkey, and for others, it's gradual. "I'm going to slowly step away. First, I'm not going to answer the phone calls. Or this holiday season, I'm going to skip Thanksgiving dinner and see how that makes me feel." It can be a very slow process. Also, remember that in that state of grief afterward, if you ever find yourself saying, "I want to try again," that's okay too. What if siblings or other relatives get angry with you? Your aunt is calling you. Your grandmother is calling you. Your brother. Now everyone else is jumping into the mix saying, "How dare you? I can't believe you're not speaking to your mother anymore." For some people, family is everything, so you have to explain to them. "For me to be a healthy adult and for my nervous system to be safe, I actually have to cut ties with my parents." Again, this is why it's important to have a stable community environment, a professional one and a personal one, because there are so many intricacies that take place when someone decides to remove themselves from a family unit. You need to have those supportive systems available to you because it can be heavy, and that is okay. You write in your book that some people of color can be hesitant to tend to their mental health via therapy. Do you have any special advice for them? Support groups for people of color can be extremely helpful and inexpensive compared to therapy. Many of these groups are led by therapists. To find therapist-led groups, visit directories like psychologytoday.com, nonprofits such as Mental Health America and NAMI, also share resources where people can find support groups in their local communities. Over in culture and news, we have the snack drawer TikTok trend has completely divided Hoda Kotb and Jenna Bush Hager. Depending on what part of TikTok you're on, chances are you've seen the hashtag snack drawer under my bed dot trend. The concept of which is that keeping a snack drawer under your bed is the only way to live life and what we should have been doing this entire time. However, people seem to have strong opinions about eating in bed, and Hoda Kotb and Jenna Bush Hager got into a whole debate about it on Today. Kotb is very much pro-eating in bed, while Bush Hager is very much against it. "So, a lot of people like to snack in bed," Kotb said, kicking things off. "I feel you and I'm with you. A sleeve of Ritz crackers is good to have, nice and buttery." Bush Hager disagreed, saying in horror, "But can you imagine what a sleeve, first of all, of Ritz crackers does to your sheets? Hoda, you got to give up eating in bed." Kotb went on to insist that it's cozy, while Bush Hager countered with, "It's crumbly. It's crummy. Also, I fear accurate." Hoda then hit play on a TikTok and mused, "There's a new trend for people who are like-minded. So there are people are now developing a snack drawer under their bed where, look, they put their snacks in and then they close the drawer." When jokingly offered a snack drawer by Bush Hager, Coatby changed her tune and said she was worried about bugs, prompting a debate in the comments about whether snacking in bed could lead to such horrors. We're going to step on over to food and take a look at a recipe. This is for turkey pasta. When I was growing up in California in the 80s and 90s, my mom wanted to serve us a healthier version of the meat sauce her mom used to cook for her in Schenectady, New York, substituting ground turkey for beef and pork. My version has evolved over the years, and it has become one of my absolute favorite comfort foods in the world. Dark meat or white will work for this recipe. Lisa prefers white, which miraculously does not dry out in this recipe. Unlike a rich, fatty, 6-hour winter bolognese, this is that sauce's bright, light, acidic cousin that cooks in less than 30 minutes. It's supposed to be saucy and a little loose, and you are encouraged to lift up the bowl to your face at the end and slurp up any sauce left at the bottom. It's also not a very meaty, heavy sauce, but since most ground turkey comes in 1-pound packages, this recipe is essentially a double batch, which is great because leftover sauce freezes well. I encourage you to make the full batch and only cook as much pasta as you are going to eat right away, freezing the rest of the sauce for a weeknight when you don't feel like cooking. Note, any short dried pasta will do, like rigatoni, farfalla, fusilli, and the like, but if you want to really do it right, eat it with wagon wheels like I did as a kid and still do. Okay, and here is the actual recipe. For this particular batch, it yields 3 to 5 servings. Here's the ingredients. 1 medium carrot, roughly chopped. 1 celery stalk, roughly chopped. 1/2 cup of loosely packed fresh flat leaf parsley. 1 small onion or 1/2 medium onion, roughly chopped. 3 garlic cloves peeled. 3 tablespoons of olive oil. 1 pound of ground turkey, 1/2 teaspoon of dried oregano, 1/8 teaspoon of crushed red pepper or more to taste, 1/2 cup of dry white wine, 2 28-ounce cans of whole peeled tomatoes, and salt and freshly ground black pepper. Pasta and serving. Salt, 12 ounces of dried pasta, 1/2 of the turkey pasta sauce, a few leaves fresh basil, optional, roughly torn, freshly ground black pepper, and freshly grated Parmesan or pecorino, that's P-E-C-O-R-I-N-O cheese, and extra virgin olive oil. And here are the directions. Step 1. In a food processor, combine the carrot, celery, parsley, onion, and garlic and blend until you have a well-combined paste with just a bit of rough texture. It will be quite wet from the onion. Lydia Bastianic calls this a pestata. If you don't have a food processor or don't want to use it, you can simply chop all of these ingredients as finely as possible. Step 2. In a large skillet or Dutch oven, heat 2 tablespoons of the olive oil over medium-high heat. Add all of the pestata and stir regularly until most of the liquid has evaporated out, about 5 minutes. Step 3. Meanwhile, in a medium bowl, combine the turkey, oregano, crushed red pepper, and white wine and stir to combine. I use my hands and then obviously wash them. The turkey will absorb the white wine and become very loose and soft. Step 4. Transfer the canned tomatoes to a large bowl, including all of their juices. Crush them by hand until you have a rough, rustic texture, being careful not to squirt tomato juice across the counter and your shirt. Step 5. Once the pestata is dry, add the turkey mixture to the pot and stir everything to combine. Add the remaining 1 tablespoon of olive oil and season liberally with salt and black pepper. Stir frequently, not worrying at all about browning the turkey, until the turkey is cooked through and the white wine has evaporated 8 to 10 minutes. Step 6. Meanwhile, bring a large pot of water to a boil for the pasta. Step 7. Once the turkey is cooked through, add the crushed tomatoes. I like to use a rubber spatula or my hands to scrape all the juice that is stuck to the sides of the bowl. Step 8. Stir the sauce to combine and season it lightly with salt and pepper. Bring the sauce to a simmer and then continue simmering, partially covered, for about 10 minutes, about as long as it takes to cook pasta. Cook the pasta. Step 1, bring a large pot of water to a boil. Salt the boiling water and taste it. It should be salted like a well-seasoned broth. Add the pasta and cook it to about 1 minute shy of the package directions. Meanwhile, transfer half of the sauce to an airtight container or 2 deli pints and allow it to come to room temperature before storing it in the refrigerator or freezer. Step 2, drain the pasta and transfer it to the pot of sauce. Increase the heat to medium-high, stirring constantly. Add some fresh basil leaves and continue simmering the pasta until the sauce is fully combined and just barely loose. Taste for seasoning and add more salt and pepper as needed. Step 3. To serve, ladle into bowls, top with Parmesan cheese and drizzle of extra virgin olive oil. Over in Culture and News, we have Where is Savannah Guthrie? What Hoda Kotb revealed about her Today co-host's absence. The NBC News anchor hasn't been on the air all week. Ever since Savannah Guthrie joined the Today Show in June 2011, fans of the NBC morning show expect her to be among the panel of co-hosts to deliver the most important news of the day. While she's famously appeared in nearly every taping for a little over a decade, this last week has left people concerned about her current status on the show. Viewers have noticed that the children's book author hasn't sat alongside folks like Hoda Kotb, Craig Melvin, Chenille Jones, and Al Roker. What's more, frequent Today contributor Jacob Sorboroff has been sitting in on the various segments coming out of the Studio 1A, giving more pause as to Guthrie's whereabouts this August. Luckily, though, Kotb did give a major clue as to where Guthrie is at the moment, along with whether she'll be returning to the Today Show anytime soon. Where is Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show? When viewers saw Kotb and Melvin at the glass table in an August 24th segment instead of Guthrie, Kotb decided to clear up rumors about where she possibly was instead of appearing on the Today Show. Savannah is on vacation, she told the at-home audience. Craig is here with me. This explanation checks out, as Guthrie recently documented taking her daughter, Vale, to the Los Angeles stop of Taylor Swift's The Eras Tour. Posting a series of photos and videos on Instagram, she reminisced about how special it was to take her daughter on this adventure. "Memories for a lifetime with my beautiful girl," she wrote on August 9th. "Thank you, at Taylor Swift, for singing your heart out every single night. Feeling so grateful and lucky to have seen this in person with the little girl of my wildest dreams." But despite being away from the cameras, Guthrie still managed to acknowledge one of her co-workers on his special day. Upon Roker celebrating his 69th birthday, she dedicated a special Instagram post to her faithful comrade online. "Wishing the happiest birthday to the life of the party, soul of today, and dearest and most faithful friend, at Al Roker," she penned on August 20th. Swipe to the right. Also, excellent dance partner. Still over in Culture and News, Zooey Deschanel and Jonathan Scott are engaged. See the ring and all the adorable details. In the era of celebrity breakups, we finally have some good relationship news coming out of Hollywood. Looks like Jess has found her real-life Nick, because new girl actress Zooey Deschanel is engaged to Property Brothers host Jonathan Scott after 4 years of dating. Deschanel and Scott announced the exciting news to their Instagrams, posting a selfie of the two of them smiling with her left hand up to the camera, showing off a stunning new engagement ring, which we'll be discussing shortly, don't worry. "Forever starts now," they captioned the post. "OMG, so amazing, Zooey, congrats," commented actress and producer Mindy Kaling. "Nick Miller crying in the corner," a user joked in the comments. And before we get into the details of the pair's engagement, let's talk about her ring. Scott popped the question with the prettiest flower ring made up of pink, purple, and clear stones. According to People, Scott proposed in Scotland while on a family trip, and Deschanel's two kids, Elsie 8 and Charlie 6, were part of the beautiful moment. Scott, who is of Scottish descent, has always taken pride in and embraced his heritage. When his twin brother Drew got married back in 2018, Both brothers even wore kilts for the ceremony. The new fiancé had quite the meet-cute before getting engaged. They met in August 2019 when they were on an episode of James Corden's Carpool Karaoke alongside each of their celeb siblings, Scott's Property Brothers co-host Drew and Deschanel's older sister Emily. In April 2020, Scott spoke on Drew's podcast At Home, where he admitted he was flirting so hard with Deschanel when they were filming the Carpool Karaoke that the show's producer had to cut a bunch of it out. "I thought I was playing it cool," he said. Spoiler alert, he wasn't, but at least it ended with the sweetest, happiest ending. Here are some thriller book recommendations. One here is The Shining by Stephen King. In this King classic, Jack Torrance moves his family to the Overlook Hotel after earning a job as its caretaker. But once the fierce winter weather comes around, a darkness creeps into Jack that threatens his wife and son. The unforgettable 1980s adaptation stars Jack Nicholson at his, well, creepiest. Another one is The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. Created into a 2016 drama starring Emily Blunt, this story follows Rachel Watson, a commuter who catches sight of the same alluring couple every day while on her train ride. But on one ride, she witnesses something shocking, and she unexpectedly becomes embroiled in an ever-complicated investigation. This one, The Herd by Andrea Bartz. Andrea Bartz, and that's B-A-R-T-Z, breathes new life into the psychological thriller by setting her novels in modern settings. The Herd is a biting satire of a woman's workspaces like the wing and the darkness that may lurk behind that perfectly coiffed sitting room with rainbow bookshelves. This next one is My Lovely Wife by Samantha Downing. In this thriller that's been described as Dexter meets Mr. and Mrs. Smith, a seemingly everyday couple has gotten bored with their monotonous life, so they spice it up with murder. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.